Hi, everybody. Today is Friday, March 14, 2025, and our friend Laith Maarouf is back with us. Welcome back, Laith.
Good to be with you, Nima. Thank you for having me.
Let's get started, Laith, with what's going on in the United States in the case of Mahmoud Khalil. And it seems that many people don't know him, and but it's the main issue right now between Democrats and Republicans. What's going on? What do we know about this guy, and who's this guy?
Well, Mahmoud Khalil is a Palestinian born in Syria. He obviously, because of the Palestinian refugees not being able to receive citizenship there, but for me, he's a Syrian, born in Syria. That means you're a Syrian. But he worked in the United Kingdom embassy in Beirut. He was in charge of the Syria programs and had high security clearance. So he was involved in many of the destabilization programs that the United Kingdom embassy in Lebanon was handling in Syria. And he eventually moved to the United States, where he was hired also in all these NGOs funded by USAID and others that are directed to work with the Arabic and Syrian youth in the United States, specifically, clearly, to make sure that they are not radical anti-colonialists that support the Wahhabi death squads that we saw, or the Ikhwani takeover of Syria and Libya and Iraq and what have you. So he has a long career of basically working with the enemies of Palestine, the enemies of the Arabic people. He eventually was studying, doing his graduate degree in Columbia University, and the administration of Columbia handpicked him to be their negotiator with the demonstrators at the encampment after the genocide started. So he was like an in-between between the students and the administration. He wasn't basically there to represent the rights or the demands of the students, but to negotiate with the administration. But even all of this kind of collaborationist behavior, liberal behavior of Mahmoud Khalil over all of those years servicing the United Kingdom and U.S. goals in the region, that didn't save him from the Zionist wrath that we see with him being dragged to by ICE and disappeared. And this is a good lesson for any people of racialized communities, Arabs and Muslims in the West and in the world. It doesn't matter how much you suck up to the Zionists, how much you give to the Zionists as services in your hopes that maybe they'll treat you as an equal or accept you as a human being. In the end, when you collaborate with the Zionists, once they don't have any use for you, they will actually take advantage of that and abuse you as they did with Mahmoud Khalil. This is basically what also happened to Gaddafi when he gave up his weapons in hopes of the West, accepting him. We saw how they, raped him live on television, Gaddafi. So now that Mahmoud Khalil doesn't have any use for these Zionists, it seems like they are using him as a threat to the rest of the Arabic and Muslim communities. And, it's like the master in the slave era times, if he decides to lynch the house slave, the kitchen slave, in front of the field slaves, and that's going to scare all the field slaves. This is what, and I'm saying all of these criticism of this man, but of course we need to support his rights. Because if this is what can happen to a collaborationist in the United States, what's going to happen to real radical Arabic and Muslim voices in the U.S.? So it's a test case. And if, there's a another possibility, you know, beyond them lynching him publicly, to make an example, is that maybe, and this has happened many, many times during the 1960s and 70s with the Black Liberation Movement, is that, you know, he could be right now dragged through this process and still wins in court, and then he becomes a symbol of resistance and a leader in the Arabic and Muslim communities in the US because of what his Zionist masters did to him. So that will create us a you know, controlled opposition in the US. And that happened, you know, we saw how the real radicals like Malcolm X and Martin Luther King were killed, and some other leaders of the Black community in the 60s and 70s were managed or put in jail a few days here, a few days there, and then they become heroes. And in reality, they're collaborationists with the US you know, government in the oppression of the Black people.
Leith, when it comes to Gaza, what's the situation there? What do we know about Gaza right now? In terms of the aid, water, electricity, all of that.
Yeah, so the Israelis have cut off all the entry of aid to Gaza, medicines, food, water, and they cut off the little bit of electricity that we're still feeding to the Strip, and you know, continue to attack and target civilians. We see almost every day the Israeli soldiers that are stationed in the Netzarim axis and or on the edges of the you know, Gaza Strip firing on unarmed civilians as they're moving through the Strip. So, you know, on average, around 10 Palestinians are being killed directly by Israeli soldiers in the Gaza Strip. And right now, you know, the situation in terms of water and food and medicine is worse than it has been over the last 15 months. And that shows you, obviously, that the Israelis have no intention of you know, ending the war in Gaza. And they're finding different ways to punish the civilian population. And, you know, we were all waiting for the second stage of the ceasefire agreement to commence. But again, now we don't see any movement on that. And, you know, Netanyahu seems intent on going back to a full war situation. I don't know how long this, you know, slowdown of the military activities is going to continue.
Keith, how do you think right now, considering considering the forces of resistance, do you think they're preparing for a new cycle of conflict with Israel? Is that serious in their mind? Is that what's gonna come to them? Are they prepared for that?
Yeah, I think they have no choice. You see, it's not, and this is part of the problem since October 7th, is the Israelis, you know, have been taking the lead in setting the pace of the battle. And I think there's going to be changes right now in how the axis of resistance is dealing with these things. And we saw that beginning of that change with Yemen taking the initiative and saying that, you know, within 4 days, and now we're past those 4 days, that if Israel doesn't move to the second stage of the ceasefire agreement with Gaza, and the and if they don't lift the siege of, on the delivery of aid and water and electricity to the Strip, that they will reinitialize their blockade on shipping to the Zionist colony. And that's already started. Yesterday was the beginnings of the Yemeni military stopping shipping going to Israel through the Red Sea. We saw the Yemenis also announce to Russia and China and any other state that their shipping is safe. So that's an indicator of where we're, you know, the axis of resistance is going now with this. And so similarly in Iran, we saw over the last 2-3 days statements by the president Bazakhshian and officials of Iran that they are, number one, not going to negotiate with the United States on the nuclear file, that they will also most probably, if the European countries do not you know, deliver on their own obligations for the deal that was signed years ago on the nuclear issue in Iran, that Iran will withdraw from the International Atomic Energy Agency. And that also, we saw the videos that came out from the Iranian military showing all their new weapons and new underground bases with all those weapons and so forth. So those were all signals that Iran is getting ready to be back in a military confrontation with the Zionists, and that they will not be waiting for the United States and Israel to attack them before they retaliate. This is what, you know, the problem that happened during the 16 months of the war, that Iran and Hezbollah and Yemen all kind of sat back, waited to be attacked before they responded. And that was all the strategy in that phase, was to show the world how the Zionists are the aggressors, that the Zionists are the ones that violate human rights laws and international law, and to win the public opinion globally. Well, the Axis of Resistance, the Palestinians have won now the public opinion globally. There's nothing more we can do on that front. And winning the public opinion globally did not lead to any change in the positions of Western governments in terms of their Zionism and their support of the military support for the Zionist colony and shielding it from all effects of its crimes. So I think the next stage will be much more aggressive by the Axis of Resistance, and will not care for the opinions of the Western public, and will conduct military activities as ruthless as the Zionists have. So I, you know, in my opinion, this should happen as soon as possible, because the more time the Axis of Resistance takes before they're back into full military activities, the more deliveries of weapons are happening to the Zionist colony, and the more repositioning of American troops is happening in the area, in the region.
Do you see any sort of outcome of that summit among the Arab states? We had in Cairo, in Egypt, we had a summit talking about the peace plan on the part of Egypt. What was the outcome? Is there any sort of outcome? Is there any sort of sign that you see we are going to getting to the point that these people are going to help this case of Gaza?
Well, I personally don't call it the Arabic League. I call it the Hebrew League. Remember, you know, right now, the Saudis, the Qataris, the Emiratis are really in control of the Arabic League. The original founders, like Syria, have been destroyed. There's no more sovereign Arabic state except Algeria. Even Yemen, you know, we love the Yemeni resistance and their Yemeni army and so on, but they don't control the whole territory of Yemen. So the only sovereign Arabic country right now that is not under control or partial control by the Western imperialists is Algeria. So, and we saw how Algeria refused to actually send a high delegation to this meeting because the Saudis, the Emiratis, the Qataris, you know, prepared everything and didn't consult Algeria or anybody else. And clearly, the whole meeting was designed to you know, throughout all these platitudes and talk about rebuilding Gaza and all of that, which is all in the imaginary. As long as the Israelis and the Americans don't allow money and food and rebuilding reconstruction materials to enter Gaza, there's no point of it. So you can say whatever you want to, as the Saudis or the Egyptians. Yeah, we're going to rebuild Gaza. We're going to have $50-60 billion. They might as well have said $1 trillion for Gaza. We have to rebuild Gaza for $1 trillion, because it's never going to happen as long as the Israelis and the Americans don't allow it. So the whole thing was designed to lift pressure off Egypt and Jordan after the humiliation of the King of Jordan in the White House, and to make the Saudis and Qataris and Emiratis look like they are going to do something good with their money to help the Gazans, when none of that is going to happen. And therefore, this was all a charade, and it was an act. And I think only fools will fall for this. People in Gaza know this is just an act. And the people in Egypt and Jordan, who I think all of this was designed to really help these regimes in Egypt and Jordan after that humiliation, as I said, in the White House, they also are not going to fall for this. We see, you know, the Egyptian people specifically, after this summit, Egypt had already sent some tractors and heavy equipment to lift some of the rubble. We saw 2-3 days ago an Egyptian bulldozer with an Egyptian citizen inside it, the driver. He was working in Gaza trying to lift some of the rubble, and the Israelis attacked the bulldozer, killed the Egyptian worker. I mean, bulldozer was carrying an Egyptian flag on it. It was very clear. And this was allowed to enter by the Israelis. And the Egyptian government didn't say one word about the killing of their own citizen by the Israelis inside Gaza while he's flying the flag and doing the work that he was allowed to do. So that shows you that the Egyptian government is not serious about any of this. It's not even serious about protecting its own citizens. So after that killing of the Egyptian bulldozer driver, there was much criticism on the social media within the Egyptian population of what the position of the Egyptian government and how it didn't protect its citizen or protest even his killing, neither publicly or officially in writing or anything to the UN, or even if it's just for show. So the Egyptian population is getting more and more agitated. And because Trump didn't walk back his talk about clearing Gaza and ethnically cleansing it of the Palestinians, I think the Egyptian government wasn't able to convince its own population that it can protect its interests or the interests of the Palestinian people.
I think the situation in Syria is a good example of what these people are capable of. They were all against Bashar al-Assad. Turkey and Saudi Arabia, UAE, all of them against Bashar al-Assad. Right now, what's going on in Syria? I would say in 5 years, Syria may look like Gaza Strip. Israel is taking all the territory of Syria, and nobody seems to care about that.
Yeah, the situation is really bad. Obviously, there's these massacres and genocide that is happening in the coastal areas, targeting the Alawi and Christian and Shia population, as well as the Ismailis and the oppositional Sunnis that don't accept what these Wahhabi death squads are doing. So in the past, less than 2 weeks now, since the beginning of these massacres, there's already around 15,000 Syrians that have been killed in the coastal areas. and the vast majority of them being Alawis, but there's at least what we know of, at least 20 Sunni families that were killed in their homes by the Wahhabi death squads because they dared hide their neighbors, their Alawi and Christian neighbors in their homes. So this is a full genocide happening. And when we say 15,000 people in less than 2 weeks, that's a higher rate than the killings in Gaza. Okay, it's a very, very sad situation. And tens of thousands of people have fled the coast, most of them coming to the north of Lebanon. Yesterday, Free Palestine TV, our team, we went to the border area in the north, and the area specifically close to the coast, in north of Tripoli city. And we, visited all these refugees and in these villages in the north. The border between Syria and Lebanon in the north is there's a river there that makes the border. It's not a very wide river, and it's not very deep, so people are crossing on their foot. But we saw that the Lebanese tribes crossed to the other side and removed the mines. There was landmines there. So the civilians in Lebanon, in order to help their brothers and sisters in the coast of Syria, crossed the river and removed these landmines and are helping any refugees coming in. There's now tens of thousands of Syrian refugees in these that crossed the river into these border villages in Lebanon. There's not much aid coming from the government in Lebanon. There's also not much international agencies. It seems like, these international agencies that were servicing Syrian refugees over the last 15 years in Lebanon were fine servicing Syrian refugees if they're against the government of Bashar al-Assad. So the 2 million Syrians that entered Syria over the last 15 years that were in opposition to Bashar al-Assad got a lot of aid. But now this new wave of refugees that are not in support of Bashar al-Assad, but clearly are targets of the Wahhabi death squads, they're practically receiving zero international aid. Main right now aid agency that is helping these newly arrived Syrian refugees is the Alawi Muslim Council in Lebanon and Shia and Christian charities in Lebanon that are local and the municipalities. Yesterday during our visit, we saw the first international agency that came to give aid, and that was the Danish Refugee Council. And it was, very basic aid packages that have a little bit food. And it was going to be just a one time. So the questions we heard from the local Lebanese city councils in these villages were directed mainly towards the failures of the United Nations to do anything. They were directing their messages to the Lebanese government to take its responsibility to support these small villages and municipalities in the north that are, by the way, the north of Lebanon is one of the most impoverished parts of the country. So there's a lot of stress on these villages, and they've already had to deal with the thousands of Lebanese refugees during the war and the destruction. So the city councils in these northern villages are very distressed in terms of financially because of having to hold and support the internally displaced Lebanese refugees, and now right after it coming this wave of Syrian refugees. And in the south of Syria, we, of course, see the continued expansion of Israeli occupation from the Quneitra, area into the Daraa province. Over the last few days, we saw more and more the Israelis advance into Daraa. And we continue to see these Israeli air raids across the country. Most of those air raids by Israel are targeting the south. Probably they're trying to clear more path for their invading forces. And, two nights ago, actually, there was an Israeli attack on Suwayda province, which is mainly Druz. And, this is because the Suwayda population carried arms and blocked the entrance of HTS Wahhabi death squads into their area. So I think the Israelis are trying to open a path for HTS to try to attack Suwayda and start conducting massacres in order for the Druze population to feel so threatened that they may ask Israel to come and protect them, you see. So we see that the targeting of minorities, religious minorities in Syria is a design program. And one of the aims of it is to break the internal solidarity in Syria. The other aim is to force some of these minorities, like the Druze in the south, to look for a protector from outside the country, from the colonial powers like Israel. What we saw in the coast is also designed to have the Alawis call for a separation and a breaking of the country and to have their own enclave. So it's all designed, and the goal, main goal, and the final goal is to break up Syria to statelets that cannot defend themselves or challenge the Zionists and the local vassals of the West.
Where is Turkey in all of this? How do you see the role of Turkey? They're just disappearing from the scene? They're just supporting HTS?
Well, they are supporting them militarily. When the armed revolt began in the coast before the massacres, HTS, because it doesn't have a huge military, it's like something like 60,000, that's it, the maximum of HTS. They couldn't, control all the country while at the same time fighting in the coast. So we saw the Turkish military advance further from Idlib and North Aleppo to areas in Hama and further into the Raqqa province, and to allow the HTS and the other Wahhabi death squads to withdraw all their militias from those areas and send them to the coast to conduct these massacres that we saw. So, and the Turks are continuing to fly drones on behalf of HTS over the coast and other areas. So that's clear that if Turkey didn't do this, HTS wouldn't have been able to conduct the massacres they conducted, and they would have been much weaker in the rest of the country. The other thing that Turkey is doing continuing to attack the Kurdish Contras positions in the northeast of Syria, not because they're really enemies, they're all vessels of the West, the Kurdish militias, the Turks, Turkish army, and or HTS, they're all the same. And that, as we saw, helped the Kurdish Contras pretend that they are getting together with HTS because they're fearing the Turks, okay? It was all a ploy. And we saw, of course, how the Mahmoud Abdi, the leader of the YPG in northeast Syria, sign a peace deal with HTS and accept the control of HDS of the government and to even merge the Kurdish Contras into the military of the new Syrian government controlled by HDS. And so anyone that had this illusion that these Kurdish Contras were there to protect the Kurdish population against Al-Qaeda and ISIS, well, now Al-Qaeda and ISIS are in bed with the YPG. And, you know, let's even reveal it a little bit more. You know, this happened after founder of the PKK, the, you know, original Kurdish militia, that YPG is just the Syrian branch of, we saw, you know, the leader of the PKK in Turkey declare end of military activities of the Kurds in Turkey and calling on all the Kurdish militias to drop their weapons and to join Turkey in their, you know, political activities and join the Turkish parliament and so forth. And within, you know, hours, we saw the YPG agreeing to that. So even this idea that Turkey and the Kurdish militias are at war is a theatrical thing, okay? And so now we see the Turks, the Kurds, and HDS all openly collaborating together and the aim of all of three of them is to destroy Syria's capabilities and Syria's position in the region.
Just before wrapping up, Leith, this session, how do you see the way that Hezbollah and the government in Lebanon are communicating? We know that this is a new condition in Lebanon. We have a government right now, and regarding what's going on in the region and the changes that are happening, a lot of changes that are happening, how these two parties are communicating to each other?
You know, the biggest story right now in Lebanon beyond was, you know, the refugees and the continued attacks by Israel is the fact that the Lebanese government is blocking reconstruction in the south specifically. So there was civilians going back to their villages in the south of Lebanon and lifting the rubble and trying to rebuild their homes. And multiple civilians that were trying to rebuild their homes got arrested by the Lebanese authority. And the Lebanese government demanded that they get permits to rebuild their homes. And part of this permit situation is to have full blueprints of your home and that there's inspection teams that will make sure that your home is built according to the authorized blueprints. And that's basically because the new government doesn't want anybody to build basements or anything like that that could hold weapons and or tunnels or what have you. So, and this is happening at the same time as this new government is blocking Hezbollah from delivering money to reconstruct these homes, because Hezbollah promised, you know, to repay anybody whose homes are damaged by the Israelis. And while the Lebanese government is not getting any money anyways to anybody to rebuild their homes. So clearly, we're beginning to see right now a confrontation building up. And if Hezbollah doesn't defend these civilians' right to rebuild their homes, the civilians themselves will do it. And as we saw both in the north and south of Lebanon over the last few months, the Lebanese civilians didn't care neither what the Lebanese government wants and or didn't wait for Hezbollah to become take a more radical position. And so there's it's building up this and the pressure, I think, is going to there's going to be an explosion happening because of this pressure cooker. I don't, you know, up until now, the Lebanese military has not delivered on its duties. You know, Hezbollah withdrew from the south, and the Lebanese military did not work to expel the Israelis from the few hills that they occupy still. And we saw, you know, 3 days ago, one of the largest waves of air raids by Israel, like 26 attacks across the country, and not only in the south of Lebanon, some of it very much more in the heart of Lebanon. And so the Lebanese military and the Lebanese government are unable to provide any safety for the Lebanese population, and or to stop the continued violation of Lebanese sovereignty. And they're not offering anything to show that they are moving towards that direction. And so I think, you know, while the Hezbollah is still not in a full confrontational capabilities or wanting to confront the Lebanese government yet, the population, the Lebanese population itself, is reeling and very angry. I think Hezbollah has not yet taken a much confrontational position because it's trying to rebuild its capabilities militarily and its structures. And the Israelis are claiming all those raids that they have conducted were to block Hezbollah from reorganizing and rebuilding its capabilities. But I don't know how successful the Israelis have been. I don't see really any success. Hezbollah is rapidly rebuilding. And at any moment, they know that Israel could be attacking. Therefore, they have to be as alert and ready as possible.
Thank you so much, Laith, for being with us today. Great pleasure, as always.
Good to be with you, Nima. See you soon.
Take care. See you soon. Bye-bye.